From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A proud Democratic socialist stuns the political world in Florida and beyond by attacking establishment politicians and their wealthy donors.
Again, they only care about making themselves richer or making their campaign donors and their billionaire friends and families richer.
Also this week, one of Florida's sharpest political analysts shares her take on Angie Nixon's election victory.
So I was not surprised because I knew that grassroots politics still works.
We'll also look at a key congressional contest in North Florida and try to figure out why the state demanded certain changes to the science textbooks used by its students. I'm Tom Flanagan, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end of the week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. More than 1.3 million Floridians voted in person on Tuesday, pushing the turnout for the primary election to just over 25%. That's according to the Division of Elections.
Greater trust leads to greater confidence, not only in the election process, but the results. And I think it's a testament to the hard work we put in statewide, 24/7, 365. It's the hard work that we put in the non-election years that make election night successful.
Secretary of State Cord Byrd says voters can continue to trust Florida's election process for security and the speed of results. Here's more from Cord Byrd after polls closed Tuesday night.
This is another example that Florida leads in the area of election administration and security as the third largest state in the country. Millions of people are able to vote, able to do it successfully, and just really proud of the team and everything that we're able to do so that citizens can make their voices heard. And the high confidence that we have will lead to greater turnout in the general election. So we are on to November 3rd. Want to congratulate all the candidates. It's tough to put your hat in the ring, but I want to congratulate them for their hard work, all the campaigns, and everybody that put in time and effort in the primary. Now put that same effort in and even double it on into the general.
The outcome of Florida's U.S. Senate Democratic primary this week drew national attention. Jacksonville House Representative Angie Nixon won by more than 10 points against Alex Vindman, who outspent her in the race 16-1. While that outcome shocked national audiences, Tristan Wood reports some journalists and elected officials who have watched Nixon closely say they were not so surprised.
WJCT and Jacksonville Today reporter Will Brown attended Nixon's election night watch party, located at a black-owned event space in Jacksonville's Arlington neighborhood.
Well, there was a 17-year-old who was singing the Star Spangled Banner, and as she got to the last line of Land of the Free, behind the 17-year-old, the screen showed that Angie Nixon was going to be the projected winner. And when the child hit Brave, there was a crescendo of excitement and joy and people jumping around and hugging and disbelief in a positive sense that Nixon pulled it off.
Nixon's victory was driven by dominant performances among Democrats in urban centers like Miami, Jacksonville, and Orlando, but also wide margins in rural counties across the state. Brown attributes that to Nixon's campaign tactics.
She pounded the pavement. She was almost every corner of the state that was physically possible. One question I will inevitably ask her campaign is how many miles did she put on her car during the campaign? Because I can only imagine. But she went to all corners of the state and pockets of the state where U.S. Senate candidates, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, don't often show up.
Nixon has been known widely by Florida Democrats for a while. Since being elected to the State House in 2020, she has been one of the loudest critics of policy priorities put forward by Governor Ron DeSantis and Florida Republicans. She opposed laws restricting books in Florida schools and was arrested while protesting Florida's recent mid-decade redistricting. She is also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and has been a popular figure in Florida progressive circles for decades. At her press gaggle, she leaned into anti-establishment messaging.
We centered people. We put people first. I don't care about the billionaires or the corporations. We went out and talked to people and highlighted what their issues and concerns were. And we crafted a platform together with those very people on how to address those needs. That's what's wrong with the politicians today. Again, they only care about making themselves richer or making their campaign donors and their billionaire friends and families richer.
National media has latched onto her affiliation with the Democratic Socialists of America, tying this race to trends in other states where DSA-aligned and more centrist Democrats have fought in contentious primaries. Jacksonville City Council member Jimmy Peluso, who's known Nixon for more than a decade, doesn't see it that way.
She's from Florida. She understands what Florida's going through. She understands the issues in Tallahassee. She recognizes what real families and real people are dealing with.
Peluso says he thinks Nixon won because she came off as authentic to Democratic primary voters and pushed directly on pocketbook issues.
There's a lot of, you know, old school, you know, post-Cold War era thinking about the economy and about how people live. And nothing's really changed in such a way that really helps the working class and the middle class Americans. And so I think that's more or less what people want to hear. They want to hear a solution out of it. I don't think people are like dying for, you know, the DSA to take over and win all across the country. They want somebody who's younger and who has real ideas. Like, that's what they want.
Despite the primary upset, Nixon does face an uphill battle against Republican U.S. Senator Ashley Moody. Republicans hold a 1.5 million voter registration lead, meaning to win a statewide race, a Democrat would need a strong turnout from their party and would also need to win over a significant majority of no-party affiliate voters. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, for many voters in Florida's largest congressional district, the potential threat of power and water hungry AI data centers is a big issue that helped push one candidate to a primary win.
They're a huge pressure on our resources, and our rural counties see that left and right.
The state of Florida demanded some changes in the science textbooks its students use, but the big question remains, why?
These are not changes that were required to bring the textbooks in line with the state's science standards.
Before we leave the topic of this week's Florida primary election, Democrat Amanda Marie Green and Republican Austin Rogers are their respective party's nominees in the race for Florida's 2nd Congressional District. Randy Buxta with WFSU's Rural News Service broke down the results and spoke with the candidates.
Both candidates won in crowded fields, with 4 Democrats and 8 Republicans vying for the nomination. Green won with a third of the vote, just 5 points above second-place finisher Yen Bailey. Green says she was honored by the result.
16 counties is no small feat to get across, and having run across all 16 of them over the last year, I'm humbled by what we're seeing tonight, and I think everyone who ran in this race knows what it takes and should be proud of what they've accomplished.
Rogers won the Republican field by a larger margin, with his 30% support being almost double the support of second-place finisher Keith Gross. Rogers, former legal counsel to Senator Rick Scott's office, said during his victory speech this is a sign Republicans are ready for a new era of conservative leadership.
We are in a brave new world, and we need a new era of conservative leadership, people with boldness, people who are willing to take decisive action. I'm so grateful to y'all for being part of this process and for helping me win this primary and hopefully helping me win the general.
Green says that one of her major policy focuses will be on the worries of local residents with AI data centers.
These AI data centers are hoping that some of our rural counties are not going to see right through those lies. These data centers are not full of jobs that are going to be sticking around, and they're not full of jobs hard stop. They're a huge pressure on our resources, and our rural counties see that left and right, and so, you know, we absolutely need economic development.
Rogers' main policy is focusing on a national version of the Safe Kids Act, a bill that he worked on while with Senator Scott that focuses on the issue of Chinese surrogacy.
There's no reason that in California or in New York you should be able to sell American children to our number one adversary. So that is a bill I'd love to get across the finish line. It's a bill that Dr. Dunn co-sponsored, and that is going to be priority number one on day number one.
Green also highlighted the struggles that everyday residents experience with cost of living.
It's unacceptable that folks can't afford to go to the doctor and keep a roof over their head. You know, the cost of living is out of control, and Congress is not doing anything about it because they're more concerned about tax cuts for billionaires and propping up corporations than they are with serving the American people. And I hear that in every single corner of this district, which makes it easy for me to prioritize exactly what we're going to do.
Rogers says that while the district has been favorably Republican in the past, his team will not rest on their laurels going into the general election.
This district is the largest district in the state of Florida. It encompasses Tallahassee, and Tallahassee is a blue stronghold, and so it is not taken for granted that despite the Republican sentiments of the rural counties of Bay County, that a Republican is automatically going to win the seat. You've seen the seat flip over and over again in other races, and so we have to do everything we can and not take anything for granted to make sure that this seat is represented by a Republican.
Green and Rogers will face off on November 3rd in the general election. For WFSU's Rural News Service, I'm Randy Vuxta.
Florida's high school students are reading watered-down versions of some of their science textbooks, at least when it comes to climate change. The Orlando Sentinel first broke the news in 2024 when authors reported pushback from the state on global warming facts. Now an investigation by WUSF and the Hechinger Report uncovers emails showing the state's exact demands for changes or removals. And as Florida challenges climate change in its textbooks, WUSF's Jessica Mazaros reports it's also quietly updating its science standards.
Florida education officials altered climate change to changes in the environment in McGraw-Hill's marine science book. They also removed the word polluting in front of coal-burning power plants in an environmental science text by publisher Cengage. And detailed facts were removed in both books, like how climate change is killing at least 150,000 people a year, or how students at the University of Washington help their school buy renewable electricity. These details are found in documents that the state took more than a year to release. Ken Miller has written one of the nation's most popular biology textbooks for nearly 30 years, but 2 years ago, something shifted.
The Florida Department of Education was pressuring publishers to reduce or eliminate coverage of climate change as a condition for getting on the approved list.
The state asked his publisher, Savas Learning Company, to strike the words caused by human activity when his text referred to climate change. Education officials also asked Miller and his co-author to provide sources on the effects of climate change, like certain plants flowering earlier than usual.
I certainly don't have any objection to anyone looking at the writings and saying, we want to know the source for that. But what's interesting about this is demands to do that did not come on any other chapter. There was unique attention being paid to climate change.
So the authors began doing something they had never done before: cite their sources for facts related only to climate. Glenn Branch is with the National Center for Science Education. It's a nonprofit that tracks how climate is taught in classrooms nationwide. He says it's unusual for the state to edit down its climate education because
these are not changes that were required to bring the textbooks in line with the state's science standards.
Academic standards outline what knowledge and skills the students should master in each grade and subject. Florida's existing science standards mandate that climate change be taught in certain high school electives like earth, marine, and environmental sciences. Even so, the state got a D grade from Branch's organization because the subject isn't covered in depth or in any required classes.
The only way you can do worse is to get an F, which Texas managed.
Only a few months after Florida asked publishers to edit out climate change, the state also started recruiting volunteers to update its science standards for the first time since 2008.
So we are here. It's March 23rd to 26th in Tallahassee.
Three teachers are sitting in a meeting room overlooking Tallahassee's Capitol complex. It's one of multiple meetings held in person and online to determine what millions of Florida's children will learn about science for years to come. State education officials did not respond to repeated questions on the topic, so it's unclear whether Florida's updated science standards will include climate change. Pushback to climate education in Florida isn't just happening behind closed doors. It's happening out loud from the governor himself, Ron DeSantis. He officially removed references to climate change from state statutes back in May of 2024, which happened right before the state asked for these textbook edits and standards updates.
In some ways, global warming has always been controversial politically.
Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida. He says there are two big reasons why Republicans generally reject the idea of global warming.
The Republicans have usually been more focused on the economy and economic growth. And Republicans have also traditionally, and maybe still today, it seems, but at least traditionally, were the party of big business.
When it comes to climate change, big business interests include oil and gas companies. The money and politics has now trickled down all the way to Florida's classrooms, says one educator who asked to remain anonymous and to change his voice.
Now, we can't teach the kids about climate change.
The Central Florida middle school science teacher is afraid of retaliation from parents, his school board, and the state. But he says that hasn't stopped him from teaching his students about climate change.
We're in a state that is arguably the most affected by climate change and will continue to be. And DeSantis is just pretending like it doesn't exist.
A high school English teacher from the Tampa Bay region also asked to speak anonymously. She describes a culture of caution. For her own protection, she was asked by school leadership to not speak of controversial topics in her classroom.
There is this like culture of self-censorship that I've seen developing over the past few years I've been teaching, where we're trying to predict what is going to be a problem.
But she says it's an ambiguous list that grows daily, sometimes because of just one indignant parent.
I think it's going to get less and less flexible with what you can teach and how you can teach it. I think we're moving towards having scripted curriculums.
Alicia Imam was a 17-year-old senior at Tampa Bay Technical High School when she was interviewed for this story last year. She was taking a college-level course on environmental science.
It's pretty important to me because we're a part of the environment, all of us.
Taking this advanced placement class as a senior was the first time she really got to study climate change in school. Up till then, she relied on
mostly the internet, just like reading articles.
After learning how the state is actively diluting climate education, she says,
I don't feel good about it at all.
Imam says she's witnessed the effects of climate change, like the flooding events in 2024, which devastated people close to her.
Even though I haven't been alive for that long, I'm seeing these changes happen in real time. It kind of makes me scared for what's going to happen in the future.
Imam wants to be a civil engineer and says her generation needs to learn about climate change so they can find solutions for it. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
The story was co-reported by Katie Wirth of the Hechinger Report, with additional reporting from WUSF's Douglas Soule. You can read responses from textbook publishers at WUSF.org. A French court recently blocked what would have been the first European social media ban for children under 16. A key reason for age restrictions on social media is growing concern over the mental and physical harm that too much exposure can cause among young people. WGCU's Mike Walcher talks with Dr. Christopher Hughes, a pediatric behavioral expert with Lee Health in Southwest Florida, about the potential dangers of too much online activity on developing minds.
When kids and teens are interacting on social media, there's a couple of things to consider. One is, you know, the time. How long are they spending on there, and the type of thing they're looking at, the type of content they're looking at, and also just the overall interaction they're having with others on there. And what we definitely know from the research that we've been seeing come out here recently is, you know, the big ones are definitely concerns with depression, concerns with anxiety, concerns more specifically with body image issues, oftentimes seen in girls especially. And then we'll also even just see things like more likely to engage in risky behaviors. We definitely see kids and teens who are already prone to taking risks, being encouraged to sometimes engage in more risk-taking behaviors, and also even changes in attention and focus. And we see that at school too, where time spent on things like social media platforms, where they're getting lots and lots of input from the likes and the notifications and the new posts from people, and the novelty they're seeing constantly throughout that interaction with social media. So all of that can affect attention and focus in school as well. Those are, I would say, the main psychological impacts we would be concerned about in our kids and teens right now.
Yeah. Now, some health experts have compared social media use to addiction, nicotine, alcohol addiction. Is that a little over the top, or is it reality, do you think?
Yeah, so I've heard this this metaphor, this analogy, and yes, there is some truth to it. The way that research is showing us about how kids are affected by social media, and even by gaming as well, when you interact with something like social media, you're getting little hits of what is called dopamine. It's a feel-good chemical in our brain, and it comes about and it gives us a very sense of reward, a sense of motivation, and it keeps us wanting to come back for more. And so, yes, it can create this addictive quality to wanting more and more and spending more and more time, similar to how you would see in a person who's addicted to a substance.
Yeah. Are there other health issues that could stem from overuse of social media by children?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a concern with kids and teens. As I mentioned before, they are still developing when it comes to things like their executive functioning, their ability to know how to inhibit or stop themselves from doing something, to moderate their use of things. Kids just naturally are not great at that yet, and so adults are important in helping that happen. But so when kids are overly using things like social media, especially into the evening, it is cutting into their ability to go to sleep and get quality sleep. Kids who are staying up late into the night are not getting quality sleep, which is then leading to more stress response in their brain. And when we have that overly tired feeling in our brain and that stress response happens, it can create stress, it can create inflammation, and it can lead to a higher risk of things like depression and anxiety. That can definitely lead to concerns with physical ailments as well.
What would tell a parent or a caregiver that this child is getting too involved with social media? What are the signs?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're seeing a dramatic increase over time of spending more time and more time on social media, that can definitely be of concern. If it was at a certain level and now it's starting to climb up. If they are doing things like purposefully lying or deceiving or sneaking access, that's definitely a sign of a concern. If they are starting to see decreases in things like school performance, or if it's a teen who has a job, when it's affecting their day-to-day functioning, their lives, their ability to succeed at school or work, things of that sort are definitely some big indicators to look for.
That was Dr. Christopher Hughes, Lee Health Pediatric Behavioral Expert, speaking with WGCU's Mike Walcher. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, so far this year, Florida has seen about 2,700 wildfires char more than 260,000 acres of land. This damage has united organizations to learn more about the formation of these blazes and the best way to combat them. Kate Cronin ventured into the brush to get up close with the educational experience.
Welcome to the Naples Botanical Garden. At first glance, this blaze might spark fear for the tropical preserve, but this fire is actually on purpose. Garden Director of Natural Resources Eric Foat is setting the land on fire today to prevent fires tomorrow.
When the garden purchased the land, fire hadn't been part of the habitat for many, many years, maybe decades. That's not natural, and so if a lightning-caused wildfire struck in there, that'd be a real problem. And so by doing these controlled burns, we're reducing like the fuel, all the dead vegetation. And so hopefully if there is a wildfire, the neighborhood will be safer for it.
Today's prescribed burn is unlike any other. The garden is inviting a host of environmental groups, staff from the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation to Big Cypress Preserve, to even the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida are learning how to be better equipped to handle prescribed burns. Like experienced burner Gene McCollum, who conducted prescribed burns for over 20 years and now volunteers post-retirement with the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary.
I'm definitely concerned about plants and animals in Florida. That's my whole life. So it's important that it burns, and if I can help and get more areas burned, that's what I want to do.
James Panseroli is a new recruit and works as a natural resources associate at the garden.
It's definitely a cool, intense experience. You get to see the flame heights like double or triple the height of what the actual grass height is. So it's definitely like a big wow factor. You can get a little, you know, adrenaline rush. You can get a little afraid maybe of the flashiness of the flames and the smoke. But if you actually sit back and watch and take a breath, like you can see how the fire is behaving.
Everyone has something to learn, but Fote has a surprise for even the most experienced fire veterans.
We usually have a lot of issues here with spot overs and things like that. So this is going to be opportunities for people to like see all that in action.
So a spot over would be an ember from a prescribed burn that leaves the area and lands somewhere where it's not intended or supposed to, and then it starts another fire. So that fire is now not part of the plan, and so it needs to be dealt with and addressed.
While burners prepare their brush trucks, specialized vehicles designed to navigate wild terrain and extinguish fires, garden staff set off a spot over fire.
Definitely was surprising. It would be in the position that wouldn't normally happen with the wind direction that we had today. So everyone was kind of confused, like, there's a spot? How does that happen? So it kind of was good practice, like, to keep everyone on their toes and good training for, you know, when you're out in a bigger area in forestry.
Burners rush to contain the spot over fire before it spreads.
Let me get this line open.
They quickly get the blaze under control, and their reward? Everyone gets a turn igniting patches of sand cordgrass.
It loves to burn. You need to be really, really careful with this grass.
Allison Webb is a burn boss, or certified professional, in charge of planning and executing burns. An employee with Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary, she shows recruits how to properly light a fire.
All of us are prescribed fire practitioners, and it's a great chance to take our knowledge for those of us who've been burning for a while and pass it on to the next generation and continue that education and learn from each other.
At the end of the day, after each spark has been squashed, the burners discuss how they'll implement what they practiced. One thing Fote is sure to remember is how these teams came together.
I think that's what really when you get the most learning is when you have different people and perspectives coming together to teach each other. And so it's been really great. And I think that was shown today out in the field from what you all saw.
I'm Kate Cronin.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn, Jessica Mazaros, Douglas Soule, and Mike Walcher, along with Kate Cronin. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from T.C. McGuire, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.